Chapter 12. Plasma Comes Alive. In this chapter, I am going to bring together arguments to show that dusty plasma in space can, and probably has, evolved life and intelligence. The phenomenon of a burning candle illustrates the significance of dust. We have all seen burning candles, but how many of us realize that the flame of the candle is a small plasma? And why is the candle flame yellowish? That is because of the tiny particles of unburnt carbon dust, soot, embedded within the plasma, which arise out of the wax or tallow as the candle is burnt. When they reach a temperature of incandescence, they burn with a yellow color, and that colors the flame in the way that is familiar to all of us. The temperatures of the tiny carbon particulates, as they burn in a candle flame, can exceed 1,000 degrees centigrade, and yet you can pass your finger through the flame without harm. This is another reminder of the highly complex natures of some plasmas, and that, as we mentioned at the end of the last chapter, extremely high temperatures can occur within them in pockets or isolated sections or bounded cells, while the surrounding plasma remains cool. If we do not realize and emphasize the extraordinary complexities that make these bizarre internal disparities of plasmas possible, we cannot understand the evidence that will continue to be brought forward as to how there can be, as some scientists are now claiming, and also myself in what I have said about the Kordalevsky clouds, living intelligent plasmas. As plasma research progresses and becomes more and more urgent, while also becoming more and more bizarre, there are increasing numbers of experiments being carried out on what are called cryogenic plasmas, plasmas at extremely low temperatures such as we never encounter in normal life, which can only occur on Earth in scientific laboratories, or in tubes of liquid nitrogen or other substances made in laboratories. Scientists are creating plasmas and injecting them into substances at extreme low temperatures, such as liquid helium, to see what happens. Liquid helium is so cold that its temperature is approximately minus 269 degrees centigrade, which is minus 452.2 degrees Fahrenheit. At those low temperatures, a different temperature scale is used, known as the Kelvin scale, named after a Scottish scientist named Lord Kelvin, 1824 to 1907. Using that scale, liquid helium has a temperature below 4.2 degrees Kelvin, which is also written 4.2 degrees K. Capital K. The Kelvin scale is a purely scientific temperature scale, which sets zero at what is known as absolute zero, which we never encounter in daily life. Surprising differences occur in what are called high-temperature liquid helium plasmas, which are near to 4.2 degrees K, and low-temperature ones, which are much closer to absolute zero. Different phenomena appear at the different temperature ranges, and no one really understands all of that yet by any means. The reason I refer to these cryogenic plasmas at this point is because in 2005, a team of Japanese scientists funded by the American government's Asian Office of Aerospace Research and Development, AOARD as they call it, made an astonishing discovery. They found unexpected high temperature of charged carriers in the plasma, meaning that surprising temperature variations can occur within plasmas, even when these occur within host plasmas that are very near to absolute zero. This is far more extraordinary than being able to hold a neon light tube when it contains electrons that are twice as hot as the surface of the sun. This is like finding a patch of heaven that is deeply embedded in hell. Let us recall that it was only in 1941 when Lyman Spitzer suggested for the first time that the huge clouds of interstellar dust that astronomers had observed for a long time through their telescopes might not be inert and useless stuff, but might be capable of becoming active and be charged dust. He said that negative electrical charges could be transferred to the dust by electrons in what he still called ionized gas, by which he meant what today we call plasma. Spitzer was making a tremendous conceptual breakthrough, and today, electrically charged dust is a subject of such importance that it is talked about every day by scientists and technologists all over the world. That is not because they are all trying to figure out the universe. There are more practical reasons. The dust that occurs within plasma is of crucial importance in the electronic microchip manufacturing business, where too much dust in the plasma interferes with the deposition of circuits onto microchips and nanochips. And also, as we have seen, in connection with attempts to control nuclear fusion for power generation. It is no exaggeration to say that trillions of dollars are at stake on matters concerning dust, how to understand it, how to deal with it, and even how to use it. The following year, in 1942, Hannes Alfven, some of whose breakthroughs we examined in Chapter 8, discovered the, quote, band structure, unquote, of the solar system, and was able to demonstrate that electromagnetic forces associated with a dusty plasma cloud, from which the solar system was formed, must have been dominant over the more usually mentioned gravitational forces in the formation of the solar system by contraction and solidification from, you guessed it, dust. And that dust would have been electrified dust. Electromagnetic forces are so much stronger than gravitational ones that they exceed the latter by a factor of 10 followed by 39 zeros. Just try and work that out. That is a really big number, folks. That's the superiority of electromagnetic forces over gravitation. By 1954, Alfven had elaborated his ideas further and insisted that the planets and comets of our solar system, and by implication those of all other solar systems, were all formed as a result of the coagulation of dust particles in the solar nebula, which means the dust clouds surrounding the early sun, as a result of being electrically charged by plasma. The dust was more important for the solid planets, of course, since the giant planets largely consist of plasma that is not solid. Many plasma scientists now suggest that stars form initially from dust. What happens is that the charged dust in a large plasma cloud in space coagulates to form a dust ball, which constitutes what is called a protostellar core, around which more of the cloud slowly collapses until a star is formed. This would seem to be a variation on the biblical injunction to the effect that, remember, O sun, that charged dust and plasma thou art. Wouldn't it be amusing if the center of our sun was really a cold, compressed dust ball? As mentioned earlier in Chapter 3, in August of 1981, the satellite Voyager 2 took photos of the rings of the planet Saturn, and the rings were seen to contain mysterious radial shape-shifting spokes. The scientists J. Hill and D. Ashoka Mendis in 1982 suggested that these spokes consisted of charged dust, which was charged in a plasma. This was the first major invoking of charged dust to explain a solar system anomaly that had been discovered on another planet, and greatly raised the profile of dust within the scientific community. The suggestion was later amplified by Christoph Gertz and Gregor Eugen Morphil in 1983, who suggested that the charging was caused by plasma bursts on Saturn. In 1986, Norman R. Berggren published a book suggesting another theory about the rings of Saturn involving an extraordinary theory connected with ET. It is very far from being a purely scientific theory. The book was called Ringmakers of Saturn. The late Norman Berggren was a scientist who had an entirely different explanation for these spokes. In his book, he suggested that not only the spokes of Ring B, but the whole of Ring A of Saturn were being artificially created by mysterious cylindrical craft of extraterrestrial origin, possibly manned by intelligent robots. Both in his book and in many later talks, some of which can readily be found on the internet, Berggren has shown photographs of strange cylinders of enormous size orbiting Saturn, which are spewing out what he calls streamers. He claims that these are plasma streamers, although he does not appear to have any idea as to why this is being done. His idea of strange cylindrical craft emitting streamers of plasma arose from a chance personal observation that he made of such a craft in the atmosphere of the Earth off the coast of California in September 1971, which was also viewed by his wife from a separate location. By triangulating their observations, he and his wife were able to place the UFO at a distance of 60 miles off the coast of Monterey Bay. Berggren calls these craft EMVs, for electromagnetic vehicles. Although this sounds very fanciful, I was told in 2015 by a friend who knows top scientists and officials at DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of the U.S. government, which is by far the most advanced weird science organization or agency in America, which developed stealth aircraft, among other things, that the DARPA people not only know of, but accept and worry about, the intrusive cylindrical craft, which they accept are, quote, not of this earth, unquote. They may come from another world, another dimension, the future, or whatever you like, but they do not come from any human civilization of the present day. Some of the cylindrical craft can be of such enormous size that no contemporary civilization on Earth would be capable of constructing anything so huge, even if it were sitting on the ground. It is apparently known and accepted by the scientists at DARPA that these craft have intimate connections with a highly advanced plasma science that is far beyond our present understanding or capacities. Apparently, they also believe that they are not manned by living beings, but by hyper-intelligent robots that come from, quote, somewhere else, unquote, but no one knows where. No living entities could accomplish these feats, as the gigantic tasks involved could only be undertaken by robots over extremely long periods of time, far exceeding any conceivable human or other organic lifespans. Just in case anybody thinks that constructing spaceships by robots is far-fetched, I can point out that we humans are already doing it. The London Sunday Times, published on the 15th of August, 2021, page 9 in the money section, had an article entitled Backing the Spaceships Being Built by Robots, which reported that the American company Relativity Space is building its, quote, Stargate, unquote, factory, which will build rockets through 3D printing, yes, that's true, and assemble by robots the more than 100,000 parts that must go into each spaceship. I mention all of this about Berggren's ideas in passing without personal comment, because it is not the subject of this book. However, it appears that the urgent impetus behind much of the advanced plasma research going on at the moment comes from DARPA, who are desperate to try to understand the intruders, if they really exist. They seem to think they do. Another reason is that stealth aircraft can be much improved if Bose-Einstein condensate technology can be mastered for the exterior skins of the planes. That's obviously named after two scientists, Bose and the very familiar Einstein. That relies upon extraordinary discoveries which have been made since 2010. Although this relates to our subject, it has been necessary to remove my account of it from the book for reasons of space. The technology is named after Satyendra Nath Bose, who was Indian, and Albert Einstein. We saw earlier that in 1986, Hiroyuki Ikeji predicted that plasma crystals, known as Coulomb crystals, could be formed by dust particles in a plasma. The existence of such crystals was announced at a conference in 1993 by Hubertus Maria Thomas and Gregor Eugen Morphil, and in 1994 simultaneously published by three separate teams, consisting of Thomas and Morphil, Junho Chu and Lin Yi, and Yasuki Hayashi and Kei Tachibana. At this point, dust reached a new high. Much of the dust in outer space actually takes the form of what are called dust grains. They are minuscule but more solid than the kind of thing we are used to in the form of household dust. How much dust and dust grains is there in the universe, in proportion to everything else? According to the physicist Douglas C.B. Whitett, author of the book called Dust in the Galactic Environment, the following is the case. Quote, submicron-sized solid particles, dust grains, account for roughly 1% of the mass of the interstellar medium. Despite their relatively small contribution to the total mass, the remarkable efficiency with which such particles scatter, absorb, and radiate starlight ensures that they have a very significant impact on our view of the universe. For example, the attenuation, which means the weakening because of distance, between us and the center of the galaxy is such that in the visible wave band, only one photon in every 10 trillion reaches our telescopes. The energy absorbed by the grains is re-emitted in the infrared, accounting for some 20% of the total bolometric, bolometers measure luminosity of the galaxy, end of quote. Luminosity, by the way, is a measure of the absolute brightness of something such as a star, as opposed to its apparent brightness, which may be diminished by distance and our atmospheric interference. Since we know that more than 99% of the universe consists of plasma, what little solid matter there is seems to exist primarily in the form of solid dust particles and grains, most or all of which floats in the vast plasma clouds. That reduces even further the amount of, quote, solid matter, unquote, of the sort that we see around us every day here on Earth, and it makes planets and moons even scarcer than we had thought, in terms of proportion of what exists compared to everything else. That does not mean that there are very few planets and moons, quite the contrary, for we now know that there are untold billions of them. But what it means is that no matter how many there are, they still form a negligible proportion of what exists. I do not believe that anyone has calculated how much solid matter is left after you subtract the plasma-bound dust. But as we face these facts, our familiar world is shrinking in significance all around us in the most drastic fashion. And as I have already pointed out, if we have a science that is entirely based upon living in an atypical world, our science is going to be atypical. So we must reform it at once. Are some plasmas alive? We have been following the observation and testing of the influence of electromagnetic fields in the work of Langmuir, Alf Venn, Kapitsa, Bostick, and others. Plasmas are bounded entities that persist through time, a characteristic of any living organism at the most basic level. Plasmas may feed on fresh plasma and be nourished, for example, by solar winds. They may even compete for such food. Plasmoids seem to bond with one another and interact in other ways. We have seen particles in plasmas swarming like microbial beings in Chapter 3, and forming other patterns such as hexagonal structures, spirals, concentric circles, and double helix patterns in Chapters 2, 3, and 11. Nerve-like filaments grow in plasmas, including those that form double helixes, and may carry information as well as energy. Plasmas seethe with movement in and around their own internal structures created by electromagnetic fields. Complex plasma entities have countless plasmoid regions within them, all protected within their sheaths and separated by voids, like organs in animal bodies. Some contain hot plasmas, some cold plasmas, some dusty plasmas, some non-dusty voids, some containing impurities that may hinder or accentuate the flows of charged currents in the manner of electronic semiconductors and transistors. In other words, large plasma clouds are bound to have the equivalent of semiconductors scattered throughout themselves in order to modulate the current flows. We have seen in the work of Peter Kapitsa that the crystalline structure of complex dusty plasmas makes them potentially far more complex than human bodies. There are soft, broadly crystal-like structures that grow into beautiful and intricate entities with the ability to transmit information over vast distances. Particles within a plasma can interact in concert with other particles. Furthermore, and as we shall see shortly, the mysterious ability to move through objects without changing form, seen in quantum mechanics in the phenomenon associated with solitons and sometimes called tunneling, takes place between organs in a plasma. We will return to this later when we will explain tunneling. There is no universally agreed, mathematically precise set of defining qualities of a living entity, but most accounts include growth, cellular form, reproduction, response to stimuli, ability to receive and process energy. Of course, living beings that are not carbon-based, like ourselves, will not be alive in exactly the same way that we are, but will be alive nonetheless. We met Vadim Nikolaevich Sitovich in Chapter 3. We mentioned that this leading Russian researcher into plasma and collaborator and co-author with Nobel Prize winner V. L. Ginsberg in the 1970s wrote in 2007 that the principles used to define life are autonomy, evolution, autopoiesis, which means a system capable of reproducing and maintaining itself. He concluded that, quote, complex organized plasma structures exhibit all the necessary properties to qualify them as candidates for inorganic living matter that may exist in space, provided certain conditions allow them to evolve naturally. Are there intelligent plasmas? What are the defining qualities of an intelligent living entity? For a plasma to count as intelligent, and with an intelligence that involves features a bit like our own, for example, memory, the ability to perceive, communicate, model, choose, predict, and manipulate reality. For that, you may need a much greater level of complexity. You probably need a series of interdependent systems with both internal and external functions, plus an overarching system that coordinates the smaller systems. In Chapter 5, we saw that plasmas in the form of ball lightning appear to act intelligently, or at least to operate by an intelligence. We saw how they appear to navigate, following aircraft or submarines. They know which way they are heading, turning at right or other angles, being still, and then suddenly moving away at vast speeds, and even rolling down the aisle of an aircraft as if on an inspection visit. Kapitsa's discovery of the crystalline structures in some complex dusty plasmas, discussed in Chapter 5, and the realization growing from that, and based on the analogy with crystals in metals, suggested to me that it may be possible to calculate the density of electrons within a plasma. I realized immediately that this density could be crucial when calculating the likelihood that intelligence might evolve in a plasma. This was much on my mind when I approached my friend, the mathematician and astronomer Professor Chandra Vikramasinghe. who, like me, was a friend and huge admirer of Fred Hoyle's and had been mentored by him. Fred supervised Chandra's PhD, and they co-authored numerous works. Chandra and I agreed to co-write an academic paper on the Kordolevsky clouds, considering their potential to evolve intelligence. What follows is an edited extract with the mathematics removed. The full paper can be found as Appendix 1 in the book and can also be found on the book's dedicated website. The Kordolevsky cloud, at the point in space between the Earth and the Moon known as L5, the L stands for Lagrange, has a density over 100 times higher than the density of ambient interplanetary dust. The math shows that the mean distance between neighboring particles within the cloud is thus very short indeed, yielding the possibility of interparticle communication if electromagnetic signals can be exchanged. This could be made possible because the dust would be charged to a potential of a few volts because of the photoelectric effect caused by absorption of solar ultraviolet photons. And collisions with ambient gas, also, would lead to rotation, spinning, at radio frequencies. Spinning charged grains, particularly those in the form of elongated needles, typified by bacilli, would be efficient absorbers and emitters of electromagnetic radiation. This production of radiation because of spinning is explained more simply in a moment, by the way. Most interestingly, the total number of such charged dust particles in a Kordolevsky cloud with a distance of less than 1 centimeter apart would be truly vast. That's the end of the quote from the article. With electromagnetic wave emission absorption across cloud dimensions, as well as electrical connections, charge current exchanges, between adjacent charged particles, only centimeters or less apart, a Kordolevsky cloud might well be able to function as a gigantic computer brain, capable of storing and processing digital information. The math also shows that the cloud may have a super-astronomical sum total for its potential computing power, exceeding the computing power available in all human brains, and indeed all other intelligent life on Earth as well, by very many orders of magnitude. Finally, we refer to a few of the remarkable features that are known to characterize dusty complex plasmas, and which could also play a role. The nucleation and growth of dust within such plasmas have been documented in several laboratory studies. In our case, however, the dust nucleation process will be sidestepped, and condensation within Kordolevsky clouds is likely to occur upon pre-existing interplanetary, potentially biological, dust particles. Thus, we could envisage a population of bacterial particles coated with semiconducting siliceous mantles that may well enhance interparticle electronic connectivity. Such speculations may sound far-fetched, but they lie within a broad framework of possible outcomes based on known behavior of complex dusty plasmas. We might thus be tempted to view dust balls as highly structured intelligent systems, capable of storing and processing information, and realize that they may have many more surprising and unexpected features. Indeed, such huge stable entities that have presumably endured for astronomical timescales and have steadily grown in complexity over billions of years may display spontaneously evolved phenomena resembling those of the most highly complex living entities. This situation is not dissimilar to the brain-like complexity of the cosmic web discussed by Ginsberg and his colleagues in 2019, although it is potentially even more impressive in its computational potential. The dust balls would contain an intricate combination of charged dusty plasma in gaseous, liquid, and crystal states, with regions of positive charge and regions of negative charge, separated from each other by sheaths and double layers, and containing superconducting filaments, so that it would be difficult for us to speak of a Kordalevsky cloud as a whole being singly charged, or having a total net charge, or zero net charge. Since there would be so many multiple regions of varying charges, the total net charge for each cloud would only be relevant when speaking of the cloud externally, such as in relation to the solar wind, which is known to be predominantly positively charged. Listeners may still be wondering how such a seemingly tenuous structure as a Kordalevsky cloud can possibly hang together or cohere and become so incredibly complex. Space is full not only of dust, but also of elongated grains, not unlike rice in shape, or we may think of them as rods or cylinders, which can be as large as 1 micron across. A micron is also called a micrometer. It is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. The next smallest measure is a nanometer, which is 1/1,000th of a micron, in other words, 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter. So don't think you can ever actually see a space grain with your eyes, as a micron-sized one is the largest, and most are even smaller. It is dust spheres and elongated dust grains of this size that constitute the bodies of the Kordalevsky clouds, and they are much too small to be detected by satellites that might ever pass near or through the clouds. But the clouds are so gigantic that there are trillions upon trillions of trillions of these constituents within them. They can be very diffuse by our standards, in other words, very far apart from the point of view of our own bodies, so diffuse as to seem almost not to exist at all. After all, at our human scale, we think of the atoms constituting our bodies as being very near to each other. Of course, the idea that our bodies are solid is an illusion. Sir Arthur Eddington asserted a century ago that all atoms consist of 99% empty space. Nowadays, we might modify that to say 99% an amorphous mist of tiny, tiny particles called quarks and gluons. The point is that if you shrank to the size of a space grain, you would find that you could easily traverse an entire human body and see nothing substantial, because everything of which it was constituted was too far apart to appear to consist of anything. In other words, we would all essentially be undetectable. So everything is a matter of scale. If you were the size of a Kordalevsky cloud, you would very readily see them. You have to be big enough to see them properly, or to have technology that can reveal them, as ours has done, but with difficulty. Some of the dust grains are elongated rather than spherical, which generates the forces that are needed. That is because the space grains are each rapidly rotating, or as we also can say, are spinning. Now, this has no connection with the entirely separate subject known as quantum spin. These rotations generate low-frequency waves in the plasma, some of which have colorful names, like the electron whistler, the dust whistler, and dust cyclotron waves, Alfven waves, and electromagnetic ion cyclotron waves. Many of the dust grains are centrally levitated by electromagnetic forces. The space grains are set spinning by electrical fields, but they do more than rotate. They also quiver and bounce, to use the very words actually used by the plasma scientists who published these findings in 2002. The idea of invisible, spinning, bouncing, and quivering rice grains floating around in outer space and whistling may seem like some science fiction fantasy or somebody's idea of a practical joke, but it is all true. As the scientists say, quote, the dust grains execute bouncing motions. Furthermore, each grain also performs transverse quivering across the sheath electric field. The energy of the dust rotation can flow into the surrounding plasma and generate plasma waves. The grains are magnetic dipoles, meaning that they have positive and negative poles. They are charged either negatively by thousands of electrons clinging to each of them, or positively by protons and ions clinging to them. And those charges are directly coupled to the electric field in which the dust grains reside. It is obvious, therefore, that these spinning grains are generating collectively a great deal of energy that pours into the surrounding plasma. As a result, microwaves are emitted, and it has been proved that Coulomb crystals, that's crystalline structures that can sustain themselves and remain differentiated from the plasma sea, can form, thus creating the elements of macro-sized structures, compartments, and pods within the plasma cloud. So we see that it is the spinning grains that generate the energy to form structured clouds, as if they were a vast army of microscopic power generators, which create the organization of the whole cloud. The number of spinning grains inside each Kordalevsky cloud could be as many as 10 followed by 26 zeros. The electrical connections and current exchanges between adjacent charged grains, even if they are as much as a centimeter apart in a Kordalevsky cloud, would create a structure that might well be able to function as a gigantic computer brain capable of storing and processing digital information. Having described the spinning microgenerators inside the clouds, I will now clarify a strange fact about dusty complex plasmas that makes all of this possible. I am going to quote a few words from the plasma scientists Dietmar Bloch and André Meltzer in a paper they published in 2010. But first I need to explain that scientists have a term for describing elements of a system, such as particles, which have powerful interaction energies holding them together. They call this, quote, strong coupling, unquote. Think of a happily married couple who stick together for decades. Bloch and Meltzer mention how strong coupling works in normal solid matter, which consists of atoms with very small interparticle distances. Then they say, quote, in dusty plasma, the situation is different. If micrometer-sized particles are immersed in a plasma environment, they immediately attain high negative charges due to the higher mobility of the electrons. Therefore, even at particle distances of the order of several hundred micrometers, the mutual interaction energy of two particles exceeds by far their thermal energy, and the system is strongly coupled. At the same time, this strongly coupled system has a fairly low particle density and a favorable ratio of interparticle distance to particle radius. This combination results in a very high optical transparency, that's technical language for being almost invisible, which allows us to observe individual particles even at the center of clouds containing more than 10 to the 6th particles. 10 to the 6th is the mathematical way of writing 1 million. So you can observe a single particle at the center of a cloud that consists of 1 million particles. That's the end of the quote. So just think what this means if translated into human terms. If we speak of human beings instead of particles, it means that if there were 1 million people standing together in a vast crowd, covering a huge area of land, they would have to be so far apart from each other that even at a distance we could, with a telescope, distinguish and detect every separate individual. This brings the common phrase, you are one in a million, into sharp focus. This is what a dusty complex plasma is like. Every single particle is one in a million, and can be individually detected in principle. And yet this vast and seemingly tenuous grouping constitutes a powerful structure. Unified, coherent, and immensely complex, bound together with overwhelming invisible strength and powerful forces. For us feeble humans, who are not used to thinking of such things, we are like the public at the time of Copernicus, 1473 to 1543, who simply could not imagine an Earth going around a sun. This is how fantastically different thinking about dusty complex plasmas is from anything with which we are familiar in our lives. An analogy here on Earth would be if we were to claim that the ocean is a giant brain. Well, it is not. That is because it is here on Earth, is made of atoms, and is physical matter. This is how different plasma really is. With dusty complex plasmas, a tenuous and essentially invisible cloud in space can hold together and become a brain, even bigger than an ocean, a brain so gigantic that it is many times larger than our entire planet. We have to get used to thinking like this, and to realize that these clouds in space are so different from anything we know in our lives, or anything we could have imagined, that all of our conventional notions are completely useless. Another crucial thing to realize about plasma structures is that they maintain their integrity by means of something called the double layer, also sometimes called a bilayer, which has helpful electromagnetic properties. Two different plasma regions of entirely different kinds can be rigorously separated from one another by these double layers. The double layers are like a double skin, being a sheet of positive charge on one side and a sheet of negative charge on the other side. For those familiar with microbiology, they are similar to the double layers that occur within our own physical bodies as walls of cells, called membranes, with the hydrophilic, meaning water-loving, surface facing one way, and a hydrophobic, meaning water-hating, surface back-to-back with it and facing the other way. So, to refine what we said earlier about the roles of sheaths, crystals, and voids in plasmas, it is partly because of these double layers that vastly different regions can exist within a plasma body, practically side by side. For instance, you can have an extremely hot interior of one plasmoid and an extremely cold interior of another plasmoid. As already discussed, they can be practically next to one another, but can coexist because of these double layers, which help isolate them entirely from one another. It is such double layers that surround the Birkeland currents in space, which were discussed earlier, and which transport electricity across interstellar and even intergalactic distances. Within those filamentary structures, the current spirals can be superconductive, which means that the current can pass without loss over vast distances, and there is no resistance to cause it to diminish at all. It is often said anecdotally that the human brain contains more neurons than there are observable stars in the night sky. But the human brain fits inside a small skull. A stable, dusty, complex plasma ball of immense size, which has possibly endured for eons and experienced continual growth and expansion over countless millennia, is in principle capable of developing something resembling a much more complex nervous system than a human brain, with its average lifetime of at most 100 years. A complex, dusty Kordalevsky cloud that has existed for many millions of years might even have become self-aware, with all that this implies. It is conceivable that Fred Hoyle's fictional black cloud has a reality in the context of Kordalevsky clouds, which of course he could not have recognized in 1957. I would recommend Hoyle's science fiction novel to everybody, as it is a thrilling and scientifically based tale of cosmic menace and the race against time to save our species. In the book, a dark patch is noticed in space by astronomers looking through a telescope. It wasn't there before. How did it appear? What is it? Over a period of time, the dark patch gets bigger and bigger. The conclusion is inescapable. It is headed our way. It gets more and more threatening as it gets closer. Eventually, the astronomers notice that it is a gigantic cloud that emits no light, hence is a black cloud. No one knows what it could possibly be. It must be stressed that this extraordinary anticipation of the existence of the gigantic, dark, and invisible clouds in space resembling the Kordalevsky clouds, was published at a time when space was regarded as a vacuum, 4 years before Kordalevsky reported his extraordinary discovery. As the cloud gets closer and closer, the fate of the Earth and all its inhabitants is threatened, since the sun's light will be blotted out. It is discovered that the black cloud is a huge intelligent entity with a gigantic brain. We might even think of it as a non-glowing plasmoid. Intelligent contact is established with the cloud, and Hoyle satirizes the political as well as scientific hysteria on Earth. The public are kept uninformed for as long as possible, of course, since that is always official policy. And just when the Earth is about to be destroyed and everyone is prepared to die, something unexpected happens. The black cloud, with its supersensitivity to distant signals in space, picks up a signal from very far away indeed, in another part of the galaxy. It is another black cloud! So the black cloud, which is about to engulf the Earth, not intentionally, but because it is big and clunky, suddenly changes course and rushes off to find a new friend, and the Earth is saved. Fred's novel brings up the obvious subject of communication with the Kordalevsky clouds. If the clouds are as intelligent as I am suggesting, then they already know all about us, while we know almost nothing about them. In conclusion, from Chandra's and my paper, we can see that the particles in dusty plasmas, such as the Kordalevsky clouds, can be close enough to exchange electric signals. In Chapter 14, we will look at other great scientists who have developed ideas that can help us understand more clearly how intelligence in complex dusty plasmas might work, including Paul Dirac and David Bohm. And we will look, too, at the role that quantum properties in plasma might have had, not only in the development of superintelligence in the Kordalevsky clouds and the development of quantum computers, but in human beings, too. Chapter 13. The Mysterious Case.